I would like to, first of all, make a few points which I think got lost over the last lectures, because I didn't explain them clearly enough. One other point I would like to discuss is, so suppose I have this worksheet we've been drawing many, many times for some scattering amplitude. And suppose I'm asking you questions about what is the moduli space of matrix modulo diffeomorphisms and wild for this. So I have some moduli space of this matrix modulo diffeomorphisms and wild. It depends on the number of external punctures. And then perhaps also if I have extra holes in my worksheet, extra loops on the number of loops, which is called the genus. So for example, this would be M 5-1. Now, a lot of the statements about this moduli space require a rather sophisticated mathematical analysis. A handful of these statements, though, a handful of the properties of this manifold, though, might be visible already from what you have learned about quantum field theory. And I would like to sort of distinguish the two. Let me give an example of statements which require mathematical theorems. Well, for example, the very basic statement we gave at the beginning that you can always make a metric locally flat, locally conformally flat, two-dimensional metric. Locally, in the neighborhood of a point, you can always find a patch, find a coordinate system where the matrix is conformally flat. This is a theorem. Okay? It's not evident at all. If I was to try to prove it, I would probably do something like look at the conformal Killing equation, maybe try to convince myself that I can always solve it in two dimensions, find some vector fields which are conformally, which would look like translations in a conformally flat metric, and so use those vector fields to build some useful coordinate system or something like that. But it requires some analysis. On the other hand, suppose I ask you what's the dimension of this moduli space, which sort of calculations would you need to do? Well, based on what you've learned, we could say, okay, to the correct boundary conditions for the ghosts are implemented by this sort of ground state that we've discussed. This ground state has some ghost number, something like -1/2, if I remember correctly. One can compute the ghost number anomaly, anomaly for the ghost number current, find that the divergence of the current is proportional to the Ricci curvature. You would still need to invoke some mathematics to figure out what is the integral of the Ricci curvature over a manifold like this. But there is a very simple expression that depends only on the genus and on the number of tubes. So this would tell you how many extra B insertions you would need to make sense of a path integral on this surface. And the number of B insertions would be the dimension of this space. Okay. Which happens to be something like N plus N minus 3 plus 3 times G. Now, for a general genus, understanding this moduli space will be very difficult. But suppose I restrict myself to genus 0, to 3-level amplitudes. So in order to study this space, I would need another useful theorem. The theorem that whenever I have a worksheet like this, I can always find a diffeomorphism which maps it to a sphere with some marked points. Actually, I would probably do it in two steps. I would first observe that I can do a wild transformation of the sort that we discussed yesterday, which collapses each of these cubes to the neighborhood of a point. I do a wild transformation like this with some random wild factor which has the correct boundary conditions at infinity. This will give me some kind of a potato, right, where the neighborhood of each point correspond to the asymptotic tube. But then I would have to invoke some theorem that tells me that this space can always be cast as a round sphere with, now these points, when I do this map, will go to some point on the sphere. The theorem only tells me that I can map this blob to a sphere. It does not tell me that I can send some specific points to some specific point of the sphere. So there will be a map from blobs or from sigmas, from worksheets with metric, to collections of points on the sphere. Now, this map is not unique in the sense that there are transformations that send the sphere to itself, leaving the metric round, conformal transformations. These are transformations that send z to az plus b over cz plus d. Transformations of this sort, which are global conformal transformations, have three parameters, three complex parameters. So they can be used to set three of these points to whatever location you want. For example, you can pick a new coordinate t, which is z minus z1 over z minus z2, z3 minus z1 over z3 minus z2. You can convince, sorry, this was a 2, this is a 1. You can convince yourself that this transformation is of this form. This transformation sends z1 to 0, z2 to infinity, and z3 to 1, for example. And it will map z4 and z5 to some other positions. So we have found a map from generic worksheets to configuration of points on the sphere, modulo this identification. Vice versa, if you give me a configuration of points on the sphere, I can always blow up the neighborhood of each point by wild transformation to get a worksheet like that. I mean the south pole of the sphere. So I'm using stereographic coordinates on the sphere. So, moduli space of the correct moduli space is the space of n points on a sphere modulo this. Group of global conformal transformations.
Mm-hmm. When you're talking about the dimension of the modular spaces, so are those complex or real dimensions?
This is complex. And you're perfectly correct to say that it was not obvious a priori that the modular space would be a complex manifold. You can then wonder why. Why is it a complex manifold? Intuitively, it's because if I start with my metric, flat metric, right, and I look for an infinitesimal change in the metric. Well, a change proportional to the whole metric is trivial, for sure. So a non-trivial change will be something like this. And so see that the infinitesimal deformations of a metric naturally split into an holomorphic and anti-holomorphic part. That's why the complex, so that tells you, and if you do now wild transformations, if you write this del mu as something which has an upper holomorphic index and a lower anti-holomorphic index, then you see that this transforms holomorphically. So this notion, this guy is holomorphic, you know, this, no matter which coordinate system you use, you can really split infinitesimal deformations into two parts and call them holomorphic and anti-holomorphic deformations of the metric. And so this model A space is a complex manifold. Here we see it quite clearly. This is parametrized by a bunch of points on the sphere, and these points have complex coordinates. So here it was manifest. If you give me a more complicated geometry like a torus, then it might be not obvious at first sight. Any questions? Okay. So we have the space over which to integrate. Next, we need a measure of integration. So if you recall, the integration measure was supposed to be something like for each local coordinate, over my space of matrix, I'm going to put something like the integral of on the surface of a big ghost contracted with the variation of the metric with respect to this parameter. This is the rule. So that means that we should have some family of reference metric on my worksheet, right? Which depends on these points, at least infinitesimally. So now, let me try to restate this in a more convenient way. Let me start with a specific worksheet. Now, nothing prevents me from using this particular metric on that worksheet. So, and then deform this metric to describe nearby worksheets. Right. So the question is the following. Can I find some metric is delta AB plus some variation? Yeah, I should put a derivative. Plus some variation with the property that this surface, which is now not flat anymore, not conformally flat anymore in these coordinates, is the same as the same surface with all the points at the same location, except that zi has been moved to delta zi. And now the metric is flat. How do I solve this problem? Find for me a way to change the metric here, which once I uniformize again, once I go back to around sphere, one of the points have moved by a determined amount.
Use a different morphism that only vanishes, sorry, that vanishes around the other, like an infinitesimal different morphism that is only non-vanishing around the Zi one.
Yeah, that's a good plan. So, in a sense, we can work backwards. So let's start from here and apply the diffeomorphism. Right. Which moves this point by this amount and changes the neighborhood. So if you apply the diffeomorphism to this metric, right, the new metric will look like this. The Z bar plus the Z the V bar plus the V the Z bar. Right? The V is the vector field that I'm using. Now, so the change in the metric, right, has three parts. There is a change proportional to the Z bar that we're going to ignore. And then the interesting changes are the changes proportional to the Z, or the Z bar. One of them will be contracted with B, and the other with B bar. So one of the changes is so this integral of B A B del H A B over del let me say that my vector field was 1 at this location. Okay. And as you're saying, it's 0 far from it, and it changes smoothly. So this vector, let me take the vector field to be delta zi times v plus delta zi bar v bar. Okay. Am I saying it right? Where V and V bar, sorry, comma, where V is 1 at the location of that point. So to do something like this, I need to contract B with the variation of the metric proportional to the Z bar squared. And the same thing with the variation with respect to Z bar I will involve the integral of B bar del V bar over del Z bar. Here I was kind of using real coordinates. If I use complex coordinates, I would have to include okay. Now this is already a pretty good expression. Still not ideal because it requires an integral of the whole region. Now, But I have a lot of freedom in picking the specific vector field. Suppose that this vector field is indeed one almost everywhere, and then goes down to zero very sharply at the boundary. So that means that del v over the z is going to be a delta function along the contour. So this integral of b del v over del z dz bar, if I pick my v appropriately, could be rewritten as a contour integral over some path which surrounds zi, or some expression like this. And actually, we can really take this to be a literally a constant. Okay. So my B insertions, right, can be recast as a bunch of contour integrals around the points I want to move. Now, what happens if I so at these points we had, remember, we had inserted something like C bar, and then some vector in the matter, some operator for the matter CFT, for the scalar fields. So what happens if I have this insertion and I contour integrate around it? A B. Actually, I can even go to the back to the cylinder picture. And I have here my G. And now I have a contour integral of B of S. And there is going to be an E to the S DS. And now this is just a Fourier mode of B. We know what it is. This is just B minus 1. It's probably minus S. No, this is just. Okay. So the effect is to just insert the state 0 tensor. Let me. There is an insertion for B, an insertion for B bar. So effectively, we have replaced this integral of B bar, time, and this operator with something much simpler. So my integration measure for in the parametrization where I parameterize the spatial complex structure by points, location of operators, the integration measure is just the z bar, as long as I strip the c ghost from my operator. This is an extremely simple final answer. And so here, in this particular example, for example, I could say, okay, I parameterize my space by the position of z4 and z5, keeping fixed z1, z2, z3. Well, then here I'll insert c, c bar v, here insert c, c bar v, here insert c, c bar v. Here I'll only insert v and v, you know, v4 and v5, and integrate this in the z4 bar, the z5 bar. And that would be my answer for the scattering amplitude. So we'll now do this calculation for 4 points on the sphere. Any questions?
How do you decide which ones to put CC bar on?
It's up to you. It makes no difference. So I could decide to parameterize the space by Z1, Z2, the position of Z1, Z2, keeping Z3, Z4, Z5 fixed. I could have done that. And I'm supposed to get the same answer if the BRST cohomology, the BRST technology is working.
Is there any other justification for just putting 3 sets of CC bar on the networks?
I just gave it. Actually, I was precisely trying to give a justification different from this is what works, which is what usually is given. You can try to think about this in different ways. For example, once you live on the sphere, so right, in a sense, see if I can say it in a useful way. I don't think I could do, I could make it more confusing, but I'm not sure I could say something useful. Let me see. I could have done other things. I could have just picked some other parameterization of my space and then express all of the z's in terms of those parameters. Then I would have had CC bar, CC bar, CC bar, CC bar, CC bar, and true B insertions, which were integrated against some complicated integrand over the surface. One thing you could do is to try to convince yourself that if I say exchange the role of Z3 and Z4, I'll get the same answer, or things like that. The way you would do it is you would rewrite these as contour integrals of B. And then you could try to deform these contours and bring them around to act on other locations. Typically, what you will find is that you'll find that the true answers differ by total derivatives. And which are supposed to give 0 and after you do the integral. So, at the end, this is a fully gauge fixed expression. Perhaps that's also a good way to think about it. I fully gauge fixed the problem, I pick parameters, and I write the answer in that gauge fixing. Other choices are just different gauge fixings for the same quantity. And so the thing you should keep in mind that at the beginning, every operator has a CC bar, and then I'm just making convenient choices of how to trade B, cancel B and C ghosts against each other. PC. I have to think of some other useful way to think about this.
The S coordinate in the cylinder, it goes from minus infinity to plus infinity along the cylinder. Is that
yes.
Right? And this integral is supposed to be along a circle?
Yes. Roughly, it's a contour integral, so as long as the topology is correct, okay, it will work.
And that's like a Fourier transform.
That's right. So in general, if you have an operator and you do contour integrals of that operator around some other point, you are acting with a Fourier mode of that operator. If you do the state operator map, that becomes acting with a Fourier mode of that operator on the states.
And that's a Fourier mode of the operator on the circle that you integrated? Is that, or is it anywhere?
Anywhere, because it's a contour integral, so it doesn't matter where you compute it.
Okay. So the idea is that you could think of that circle as going all the way down to the end of the throat.
You could. That's right. That's right. So one way to think about it is that you're really shrinking this contour down until the B and the C are annihilated each other. Intended to say, well, okay, maybe I'll come back later to the independence of different choices on how to annihilate B. For now, let me just write the answer for what? For the scattering of four tachyons. So two tachyons into two tachyons. So according to our prescription, I should do something like this. But this are the very basic vertex operators with momenta. So when I take the vertex operators e to the I p1x, e to the I p2x, e to the I p3x, e to the I p4x, the answer for that correlation function in the scalar field theory is very similar to the one I gave when I had three. There's a product of absolute value squared of distances. So let me first write down the contributions from that come from points 1 to 3. So there's a 2pi dot pj from the scalars plus 2 from the ghosts. And then here I get the rest. The integral which looks like this. So first of all, some very basic considerations. This is a convergent integral. Does this integral make sense? This integral could have problems in principle as z4 goes to infinity or as z4 goes near to each of the points. Now, as z4 goes to infinity, this behaves as z4 to the sum of pi's, not before, but the sum of pi's by moment conservations is minus p4. So it behaves as minus 2 p4 squared, which is minus 4. So it converges well at infinity, which makes sense. Infinity is a point like any other on the sphere. There's in stereographic coordinates, but nothing bad should happen there. On the other hand, as z4 goes to zi, right, we might be in trouble if this is too negative. So, in order for this to be convergent, we need 2p4.pi to be greater or equal than minus 2. So minus 2 is the limiting value at which this starts diverging. This is the same as saying that p4 plus pi squared must be greater than or equal to 2. Now, this condition actually makes a lot of sense. In quantum field theory, if we use Euclidean proper time, our calculation makes sense in the most naive way if p squared is greater than m squared, where p is the momentum on the internal edge of our graph. So you can convince yourself that the regime where z4 approaches z1 is the same as the regime where in quantum field theory, where the particle 1 and 4 fuse into an internal leg. So this is just the same as the condition that you get in a Euclidean calculation, Euclidean proper time calculation. Now, in quantum field theory, what is the solution? Well, the solution is that you should either go to Lorentzian time, proper time, or interpret this as a contour integral in some complexified space, which is the same. Or you could do this calculation by first going to this region and then analytically continuing it in p squared. So here, too, there are two possible ways to do this calculation. One is you go first to the kinematic region where this holds for all i's, and then you analytically continue back. Or you do this in a slightly complexified manner by following some integration contour, complexified integration contour, where z4 is not equal to z4 bar. Traditionally, people does it as analytic continuation from this region. Doing it as a contour integral is also fun and instructive, if you want to understand the I epsilon prescription in string theory. It was discussed in a recent paper by Witten, for example, which you can find on the archive. Now, in order to actually do the calculation, it's useful to introduce a variable, the same variable which I introduced over there. And this variable makes the dependence on Z1, Z2, Z3 drop out, as it should, and leaves you with something like the integral in the t dt bar of absolute value of t to the 2p4 dot p1 and absolute value of 1 minus t to the 2p4 dot p2. So this is the two-dimensional analog of the beta integral. If you remember, the beta integral is an integral that gives you some ratio of gamma functions as an answer. And it can be computed in the same way. And it gives you something called the Virasoro-Shapiro amplitude. I don't have enough blackboard. Let me write it like this. So, do you have any question about these steps? It's mostly algebra. And now you can ask, is this a sensible scattering amplitude? Actually, scattering amplitudes like these were discovered before string theory. When people were trying to write down interesting scattering matrices, and then trying to figure out what the scattering matrix meant, and a similar one for open strings, led to the discovery of string theory, pretty much. So what are the nice properties of the scattering amplitude? Well, so this is supposed to be a three-level scattering amplitude. So it should have poles that correspond to the exchange of intermediate particles in the S, U, S, T, or U channels. And indeed, this gamma matrices have poles. Do you remember what gamma matrices have poles? What are the poles of gamma matrix? Gamma function. I've been doing too many for algebras. And zero. That's right. So this has poles whenever p4.pi is minus 1, minus 2, minus 3, and so on. Or equivalently, when p4 plus pi squared is 2, 0, minus 2, minus 4, etc. So if you think about this as coming from diagrams like that, then this is telling you the mass squared of the intermediate particles in a quantum field theory interpretation. These are precisely the mass squares of bosonic strings. So that makes sense. Now the residues of these poles are supposed to tell you something about the interaction vertices, right? In a Feynman diagram, a diagram like this gives a contribution, which is interaction times interaction divided by p squared plus m squared. So if you look at the residues of this amplitude, let me say p1, you find some pretty neat constellations between the gamma function and the numerator. A denominator. If you, so the gamma function has these nice properties. a positive integers, it's a factorial. A negative integers has poles whose residue are again factorials. So here you end up getting some ratios of factorials. There are a lot of simplifications. And the answer looks like this. Now, the crucial point is that there are polynomials in the momenta of degree 2n minus 1. So degree 0, degree 1, degree 2, sorry, degree 0, degree 2, degree 4, and so on. And indeed, when you exchange the scalar fields, the interactions vertices are just numbers. When you exchange a graviton, they are proportional to the powers of the momentum, and so on and so forth. So this is the contribution from this infinite tower of particle states with increasing mass and increasing spin. Now, a magical thing is that the same compact expression manages to have poles in the S and T and U channel. And indeed, actually, one of the funny properties is that if you sort of, you can sort of try to expand it as a sum of rational functions, you know, like 1 over S minus 1 plus 1 over S minus 2 and so on with some some coefficients, polynomial coefficients. So you can try to recover it from the residues. And you can sort of write a sum over the S channel and rediscover these. And then it has poles in the T channel, which are produced by the sum over S channel poles. It was called channel duality, and sort of was the reason people started looking at this. But for us, I would just say that this nice and complex expression is capturing all this infinite sum over intermediate states. But also, it's not, can I say, so at low energy, it definitely behaves like a quantum field theory scattering amplitude with a whole tower of massive particles. But there are also some drastic differences from quantum field theory in other regimes. So if you look at very high energy, trying to scatter particles very hard so that the S channel or T channel or U channel, the S, T, or U invariants are very, very large, then each of the quantum field theory diagrams would grow very badly. On the other hand, the total expression does not. Indeed, if you use the Stirling approximation for the gamma function, you can easily convince yourself that the amplitude behaves like e to the minus s log s minus t log t minus u log u. So if you scatter your strings harder and harder, at some point you discover that they are fluffy, they're not particles. At some point they start missing each other. You know, people discovered that nuclei were, so that atoms were not fluffy things by throwing alpha particles at them, right? And seeing that they were hitting nuclei and finding alpha particles were bouncing off at very large angles. On the other hand, if they had not seen any alpha particles bounce off at large angles, they would have concluded that the atoms were some smooth, fluffy object. If you scatter strings from each other, you don't see very, very hard, you don't see a lot of strings scattered off at large angles. So there are no partons, there are no smaller hard cores in these things. And also this low growth of the three-level amplitudes is closely connected to the fact that there are no UV divergences. Now, at the end, loop amplitudes in a quantum field theory can be reconstructed from three-level amplitudes. And the behavior of three-level amplitudes as large energy tells you information about the UV divergences that your theory is going to have. Now, we could repeat this exercise for a whole for other scattering amplitudes. For example, we could put some gravitons there. The calculation is pretty straightforward. The correlation functions are a little bit more complicated, but it's completely doable. And it's an extractive exercise. And again, you will see that, for example, if you insert a longitudinal graviton, which should give you not contribute to scattering amplitudes, the integrand will become a total derivative, and the total integral will vanish as long as all the particles are unshelled. Do you have any questions?
Is there an interpretation in terms of looking at a string theory at extremely high energies? Does it end up being some sort of free string theory?
In some regimes, this calculation can be done semi-classically. There are some regimes where there is a subtle point to your calculation, which can be interpreted as an actual semi-classical worksheet. And then these sort of exponentials can be computed in terms of the area of that worksheet. Now, you need to be careful in which regimes you go. I mean, if you go to regimes where strong coupling will become important, like when if you're trying to make a black hole, then this three-level amplitude is not going to be useful. But as long as you are curious about the subtleties of quantum gravity, which can be resolved within perturbation theory, this gives you an example. So next week, so let me say something. So in principle, we could keep going, right? We could keep computing scattering amplitudes at three level for gravitons, dilaton, and B field, and tachyon, and build a low energy effective action for string theory painfully by computing all the interaction vertices. That would be quite tedious, but doable. Next week, we'll look in a different way you can get an effective action for string theory, which is more interesting. It shows explicitly that the light fields encode changes in the parameters of your theory, and they have an effective action which tells information, sort of controls the constraints that these parameters must satisfy in order to define a good string theory. So that will be the content of the first few lectures, maybe one or two. I still have to decide. Then I'll introduce deep brains and open strings, and a few dualities. And at the very end of the week, I'll try to discuss superstrings. So the well-defined string theories with no tachyons. Now, if you really wanted to do calculations with all your C insertions and some extra B insertions, then you probably need to compute things like correlation functions of four C's and one B. Right. So how do you compute a correlation function like that? So this is a rational function of B. The OPE tells you that it has OPEs at the location of the C's. Right, so B of C of Z, B of W behaves like 1 over Z minus W plus regular. So you can just, every rational function can be expressed in terms of its poles if it behaves well at infinity. And this does, because there is nothing at infinity. So I can start solving. I apply the OPE to this, and I get something like Z1 minus Z2, Z2 minus Z3, Z1 minus Z3, 1 over Z4 minus W. Then I can look at the pole when this meets this by shifting this across. So minus Z1 minus Z2, Z2 minus Z4, Z2 minus Z4, Z1 minus Z4, 1 over Z3 minus W, and plus minus. So get a rational expression which, you can also, then you can reassemble it maybe with a bit of help with from Mathematica for the combinatorics. Right, for sure it will have poles like these at the location of the W's or the Z's. For sure it will have an overall factor of Z1 minus Z2. It has to be antisymmetric with respect of exchange of any pair of C's. Right. And then there will be some other polynomial here. So it's a straightforward calculation. Then you can insert it. You can multiply by the correlation function of the scalar field, and you'll find something. You can pick your favorite parameterization, try to compute the corresponding B insertions, see what you need to integrate B against. And convince yourself that the answer will not depend on what you choose. So you can check that this, whatever parameterization you choose for the Z's in terms of some auxiliary variable X, that parameterizes the space of complex structure, this will just produce for you the change of coordinate from X to T, or from X to Z4. Up to total derivatives.